I see opportunity throughout the commodity space. I note that those who have the courage, I mean, two different responses to the question. For most people, buying the highest quality merchandise they can is the best. Because the highest quality merchandise, the ExxonMobils of the world, the Franco-Nevadas of the world, leave you the least probability of operational error, operational risk. And participating in the recovery of a market that's oversold often gives you good enough gains that having somewhat less extraordinary upside, but eliminating the downside is a good technique. On the other hand, in panics, tertiary assets sell off the most. And there's no asset more tertiary than a pre-revenue mineral exploration company.
Rick Rule, how are you?
Well, my life is great. Thank you for asking. I'm the better for being on with you and Steve and addressing your audience through your good offices.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for coming on. Really, I'd like to start with there's a lot of chaos, or I should say crisis even, in the markets right now in the past week or so, or can even go a little bit farther than that in the commodity space. So we wanted to get your thoughts on that. But that being said, before we get that, I'd like to give a huge shout out to your staff, specifically Callie. She is fantastic. So the story goes, and I don't know if you know this, I reached out this morning. Hey, I need to talk to Rick. You're one of my go-to people, if not my go-to person in times like this, Rick. She just gave me the time and slid me right in. So you have an amazing staff, especially Callie. Please tell her that.
Andy, I have to admit this. My schedule in particular requires adult supervision, and Callie is said supervisor. So I'm delighted that you figured out how to work with my organization. Although I pay her paycheck, she's the boss, so it's all good.
I do understand, but I think the world of Callie, have thought of the world of her, especially now. But let's start with Steve. Steve, what would you like to ask Rick Rule?
Well, first of all, Rick, I'm a huge fan. I'm a huge follower. So thanks for coming on short notice and letting me join the club here. But, they say crisis equals opportunity. Now, where are you with all this, with gold stocks, commodity stocks? I mean, are you looking to add your favorite names right now? Is there a commodity sector that's becoming more attractive to you at this time? What's going on?
Well, looking to add must be in the past tense. I've been doing some adding. I saw a wonderful post by Warren Buffett that said that Wall Street's the only store in the world where people shop less when the prices go down. And I think that says a lot of things. I don't want to comment on broad markets because I don't know much about them. I don't know what these tech stocks are valued at. So if Nvidia goes down by 20%, I don't know if that makes it undervalued or overvalued. I can't even spell Nvidia, and I don't want to talk about the S&P 500 because I don't know enough about the valuations of the constituents. I stick to conventional financial services companies like insurance companies and banks and natural resources. And I can say that in terms of what I do, stuff varies from reasonably attractive to flat cheap. And that's good. I suspect in a panic that stuff might get flat cheaper. But we can discuss later in the interview this fact that sometimes stuff is cheap enough. In fact, I'll say it right now. I remember back in the COVID time, you'll remember the demand for oil and gas fell to nothing. The oil price briefly went sub-zero
Right.
before it settled out to about $20 a barrel. And at the same time, Exxon got kicked out of the Dow 30 in favor of, if my memory serves me correctly, Salesforce. And
I had the lumps.
you're supposed to look for anomalous circumstances that have depressed share prices that aren't repeatable, won't happen again, and take advantage of that. I've only been hearing that for 50 years. So here, the world's finest allocator of capital in the oil and gas business, Exxon, is being priced at $20 a barrel when the global industry average total cost of production is closer to 60 in terms of, you know, including cost of capital. And Exxon can only get kicked out of the Dow 30 once, right? They can't get kicked out twice. And I thought that the stock might go further. This is the height of stupidity. Sometimes stuff is cheap enough. And for my genius, eventually I bought into Exxon about 15% higher than I could have had I acted on my first instincts. The point of me saying all this is that many times in my career, stuff has seemed cheap. I bought it. It went down. I re-performed the value calculation, and I bought more. And often, immediately after buying more, I felt more dumb. But what you find out over reasonable time frames, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, is that those, quote, dumb purchases turned out to be extremely rewarding unless you made a mistake. And if you made a mistake, the price that you paid is less important than the fact that you made a mistake. That's all by way of caveating the fact that my suspicion is in a point in time where there's a lot of terror in the market. We don't know when and how that terror is resolved. The stuff that you think is worth $5 that's selling for $3.75 may go down to $3 or $2.50. And if you did a correct job in your valuation analysis, 5 years from now, it may be worth $15. If you buy it at $3.75 and it goes to $3, you're going to feel momentarily dumb. You can cure this with a beer. 5 years from now, if you sell it for $15, you're going to feel perpetually smart, and you can toast yourself with champagne. I think that's the message I'm trying to leave.
The title of this interview is Beer for Champagne.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Champagne living on a beer budget. That's that.
So things are being cheap enough. Is there something that you're backing up the truck on? Is there something that really excites you? You mentioned commodities. You also mentioned insurance. But in terms of commodities, is there something that maybe it attracts you more than others?
I think the most proximal, and it's ironic that most people younger than me have shorter time frames when they have longer left on Earth. I think the most proximal mover is probably the gold stocks. Because I think that the way that the administration deals with this panic is by jawboning interest rates lower and maybe ultimately printing money. If you do those two things, reduce the price of it and increase the supply of it, you devalue the U.S. dollar. You reduce the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar, and that's ultimately good for gold. The policy response that I see coming to the circumstance that we're in is likely very good for gold. And so in immediate answer to your question, for most people's portfolio, I think the optimal place to respond would be in the gold stocks. I see opportunity throughout the commodity space. I note that those who have the courage, two different responses to the question. For most people, buying the highest quality merchandise they can is the best. Because the highest quality merchandise, the ExxonMobils of the world, the Franco Nevadas of the world, leave you the least probability of operational error, operational risk. And participating in the recovery of a market that's oversold often gives you good enough gains that having somewhat less extraordinary upside, but eliminating the downside, is a good technique. On the other hand, in panics, tertiary assets sell off the most. And there's no asset more tertiary than a pre-revenue mineral exploration company. If you're willing to do the work, if you're willing to sort through the flotsam and jetsam of 3,000 public exploration companies worldwide and find the 300 or 400 that are worth considering, and buying ones that have viable projects and viable financials, if you're willing to do the work, if you're willing to subject yourself to the volatility and the absolute risk, those are the most oversold assets of the bunch, subject to the caveat that you have to do the work.
In terms of the work, I know you've been asked this several times here, but in terms of the work for our listeners, what questions, what rubric do you have? Can you share? What should we be asking to see, is this a company that's maybe legit to?
Well, thank you for the opportunity for the commercial. Any of your listeners who go to the Rural Investment College can see a couple hundred hours of instructional programming, including an hour-long interview. I think it's called 12 Nosy Questions to Ask Junior Mining Companies, where we detail specifically the range of questions to ask, the orders to ask them, and the way to consider the response. One of the things I like to do when I'm talking to a junior mining company, asking them questions, is say, so, you know, you have 20 million shares outstanding. They're trading at a buck. You have a 20 million market cap. Explain to me why the company's worth $20 million, or tell me what it's worth. In other words, talk to me about my downside before you talk to me about my upside. Now, often the company will respond, well, we have 30,000 acres of moose pasture in central Alaska, and there's a company also in central Alaska, only 400 miles away, with 10,000 acres of moose pasture, and their market capitalization is $30 million. So we must be $10 million undervalued. To which you have to say, no, we aren't asking you to justify the stupidity of the market. What we're asking is, what would happen if you took your assets and sold them privately to a knowing buyer? What is your company worth? Not what does the market say it's worth? That's a really good place to start. I'm not suggesting, by the way, Steve, that you have to buy dimes on the dollar. I'm not suggesting that you shouldn't be willing to pay a premium for good people and good potential, where the people have a proven track record of demonstrating potential and have a plan to do it. I just want you to identify your downside before your upside. It's not uncommon now to see companies that have spent $80 or $90 or $100 million on successful efforts exploration, where the property isn't proven to be commercial, but where there's lots of documentation. It's not uncommon to see the results of those $90 million in exploration expenditures being sold in the market today for $25 million. And while that's no guarantee of success, it's an awful lot better than the circumstance that exists in a bull market, where that same $90 million of expenditure might have a $300 million market cap. I think it's really important, too, and we talk about this a lot at Rural Investment Media, is understanding management track record. In the small companies, Steve, the most important asset is the people. It really, truly is. And I'm a student of Pareto's Law, which is the social science dictum around the 80-20 rule, the sort of truism that 20% of the population generates 80% of the utility in any given task. It's important to note, in applying this rule to your investments, that this is a bell-shaped curve, which is to say there are good and bad lips to the performance dispersal curve. 20% of the population generates 80% of the good utility, and a different 20% of the population generates 80% of the aggravation. And your job as a speculator is to identify the good 20 and identify the bad 20 too. Just attract yourself to the good 20 and avoid the bad 20. What becomes more useful, Steve, is that if you take these lips, these 20% lips on either side of the curve, and you run them through the same performance dispersal curve, they conformably align, which means that 20% of the 20 do 80% of the 80, or 4% of the population generates 65% of the utility. This sounds very elitist, because it is. And so your job in evaluating these companies is to find companies that are run by the 4%, not by the 96%. And I've learned in 50 years of doing this stuff that the performance dispersal curve actually aligns at least one more time, which is to say that 0.8% of the population base generates 40% of the utility. So it's important in considering which opportunities to take advantage of in panics like this that you try to identify management teams that are in the best 1% of historic performance. It's important, too, that their prior success be reasonably directly expected to contribute to the success of the task at hand. If you determine that someone's prior success had been operating a gold mine in 2-billion-year-old Archean terrain in French-speaking Quebec, but the task at hand was exploring as opposed to operating for copper-gold porphyries in 15-million-year-old accreted terrain in Spanish-speaking Peru, while the prior success is admirable, it may or may not impact directly on the probability of success in this endeavor. So you want to be involved with people with a history of success where the success is valid to the task at hand. That's very, very, very important. There's a truism that bad people can screw up good rocks, and good people can get rid of bad rocks and get good rocks. So when you're doing your value calculations, it's important that you do your value calculations around assets that are in the control of very good and previously successful people.
So I have a follow-up question in a scenario with that, Rick. And then I want to talk about the conference, and then I want to talk about energy. But my follow-up question was this. Just this week is actually, it was this week. I spent time with an energy company. I'm not going to name the name because they're a very small market cap, but we were evaluating. They were telling us all about their asset, all of that. And I, sure, whatever. But what was stood out to me was the track record of the management company, which was fantastic. But what was even more important to that, they were trading at a market cap, which was equal to what they had in the bank. Correct me where I'm wrong. Is I am, and they had no debt. So if they do BK, the bondholders aren't going to get the money first. So my analysis is, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm basically getting the asset for free. The risk lies if there's a coup in the country, and it's a relatively stable country, but it's not the US or Canada. If there's a coup in the country, and I'm going to be leaning on that country's court system. That is my risk. Correct me if I'm wrong.
There are other risks too, but those are important risks. And the biggest risk that you've alleviated is the near-term possibility the company goes broke. It's really tough to go broke if you have lots of cash and no debt. I've seen it happen, by the way, but that's a different question. What you need to do from that base, though, is you need to look at the asset base, the non-cash asset base, and you need to ask the management team how they intend to turn that latent asset base into an active asset base. In other words, how they intend to make money on it, what the process will be, what the first and second and third unanswered questions in the process of adding value will be, how long a process that will take, and whether they have sufficient money to generate the sort of yes answer that will allow the market to assign value to the project. This is really fun to do, by the way, Andy. I've been asking exploration stage companies to give me their thesis and explain why the thesis is a valid rather than a convenient thesis for 80 years, or pardon me, for 50 years. And I've asked companies to name for me the most important proximal unanswered question, the unanswered question that would go the furthest to eliminating uncertainty on the part of the market as to the value of the assets in question. And in fully 80% of the time that I've asked that question over the last 40 years, the companies haven't had an answer, which means that to them, the principal unanswered question is, will I still draw a salary in 18 months? And while I can understand that that answer is valid to them, it doesn't matter much to me. So you've made a good start. If they're credible people, you want to know how they're going to turn the latent asset, which is to say the physical asset base, and the cash, into free cash flow and a higher valuation over time. And then you need to ask them how long it's going to take. You need to decide for yourself whether that's reasonable. You know, we talked about this in the past, Andy. Many of your listeners have wonderful let's call it strategic investment objectives. They think the price of oil is going to go up in 5 years, or the price of copper is going to go up in 5 years, or something like that. But they have tactics that don't last over a long weekend. And if the process of answering the unanswered question of the oil company at hand is going to take 18 months, you need to accommodate yourself to the fact that you're going to need to own that stock for 18 months in order to realize the accretion in value that you're hoping for. If you don't, it's not the company's fault, it's yours. And it's important that this process is something that your listeners repeat, because a mismatch, a time duration mismatch between your strategy and your tactics is going to yield you really suboptimal outcome.
Got it. So I want to get to energy, and I have three stocks to ask you about. Before we get to that, I want to know again about your conference, talking to my listeners and viewers. I've said this, and I can't say it enough. It was fantastic. It treated me very, very well. I made a lot of money on that. I still own a lot of the companies that were there, or the companies that I bought. I've also have a lot of the people that are going to be at the conference. We mentioned offline, like Naomi Prinz. I just spent some time with Naomi Prinz last week, a fascinating mind, a great mind, and a lot of great insight. Tell me about the conference, who's going to be there, but more importantly, why it would benefit people.
Well, I think the headline boast is this. It is, I think, the finest investment event in the world in the natural resource business. It's gone on for 30 years. It stood the test of time. That means that there's a nucleus of attendees who are very knowledgeable. Our conference is not one where all of the knowledge flows from the dais to the crowd, but rather one where the crowd has substantial knowledge to share too. No other conference has the franchise that we have around natural resources. How did we do this? Well, first of all, as you suggest, we have great big picture thinkers. But our great big picture thinkers aren't journalists for the most part. Naomi Prinz is an example. We'll talk to you about the flawed structure of Wall Street, and she'll speak to you from the belly of the beast in a biblical sense. She was a partner at Goldman Sachs. She saw the corruption of Wall Street from the inside, not from a journalist's perspective. Daniela DiMartino Booth will talk about the Fed, not as a journalist. She was a researcher at the Dallas Fed. Jim Rickards will talk about the fragile financial structure of Wall Street from the belly of the beast. He was general counsel at Long Term Capital Management, whose failure almost brought down Wall Street. But the most important contributor this year, and I can't tell you who I am about this, is David Stockman. David Stockman, for those who don't know, wrote a wonderful book called The Triumph of Politics, which details the derailment of the original Department of Government Efficiency in the Reagan years. He is qualified to do that because he ran the Department of Government Efficiency. He ran the Office of Management and Budget for Reagan, in addition to being a senator. Again, big picture thinkers from the belly of the beast. These are not journalism grads. These are people who lived the stories they tell. It's a very, very, very different circumstance. From there, once your worldview has been shaped by players as opposed to reporters, we talk to you about how to turn that realization into money. And we do that by having portfolio managers and analysts who have been making money for themselves and for their clients in the natural resource business for 30 or 40 years. Again, there's a theme here. Not folks who failed at crypto and technology and parachuted into resources because the gold price went up, but rather people with two or three or four decades of experience in bull markets and bear markets, telling you what they did right, what they did wrong, and sharing hard-won secrets. But it gets better than that, actually. My favorite feature at the conference is something called the Living Legends. where we showcase entrepreneurs who have built multi-billion dollar natural resource companies from scratch, talking about how they did it, talking about how much time it took, telling you what they're invested in outside their own companies, which is always fascinating, telling you how to identify the $15 million market cap company that's going to become a $5 billion market cap company. I had a guy some years ago email me and say, Rick, following Robert Friedland around your exhibit floor, watching the exhibitors that he stopped in front of, and listening to the questions he asked was worth the price of admission. The whole rest of the conference was free. That's what the living legends do for you. Another important difference, I think, between my conference and all of the other conferences, at every other conference that I know of, the qualification to be an exhibitor is a check that cashes. They're advertisers. At my conference, the attendees have told us that the exhibitors are content too. So every single public company exhibitor at my conference is owned in accounts owned or managed by me. That doesn't mean, unfortunately, that every stock I buy goes up. Far from it. What it does mean is that I have vetted every single exhibitor, that I know them well enough to have invested my time, my reputation, and my treasure. And that allows me to make what I think is an extraordinary guarantee. Anybody who attends my conference live or in the comfort and convenience of their own home via live stream enjoys an unconditional money-back guarantee. If you pay a tuition to come to my conference and you don't think I've delivered, email me. I'll give you your money back. We've been doing that for 30 years. I'm delighted to say that we've had to refund over 30 years about 0.1% of the tuitions we've charged. But there's no other conference I know of in the world that has the confidence to say satisfaction guaranteed or unconditional refund. Nobody else does that.
I will put a link to all of this in the show notes below. And I also say 31 years ago, your Robert Friedland story about following him around, that gentleman that emailed you, just to all my listeners and viewers, 31 years ago, I followed Rick Rule around at a conference and did exactly that. And it really set up my investment career. Let's talk here about energy, specifically oil and natural gas. Let's talk about the outlook here. And then I got three stocks for all of our listeners I'm going to ask you about, and you just give me your opinion on them. So oil and natural gas.
Well, let's go back to an interview that you and I did about a year ago. We talked about natural gas. It's not that cheap anymore. You know, when natural gas was selling at $1, $1.20 a thousand, I said, you know what? The price has to go up. It just plain has to go up. Now it's at what, 350, 360? It went
up.
Can
I interrupt you? Can I interrupt you? Yeah. Yes. I remember that interview and you said, what do you like? Well, I like natural gas. It's too cheap. And I'm the old, here we are. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I think natural gas goes up from here, but it doesn't have to go up as much anymore. Okay. The circumstance that we talked about, which was the stuff was laughably cheap, corrected. So let's get that one straight. I still like the whole energy complex. The whole energy complex, when I say energy complex, I mean oil and gas, is priced as though the internal combustion engine goes the way of the dodo in 2030. That noted energy physicist, Greta Thunberg, has told us so, as has the inventor of the internet, Al Gore. The problem with that is they're wrong. All you have to do is use common sense. I ask you, how will they fly 700 private jets to Davos to tell us to drive less if they have no oil to put in the engine? My belief is that peak oil demand occurs probably 2060, 2065. And that's important because when people are valuing oil and gas companies, they're using a reserve half-life at 2030. And then they're running down the demand curve and so running down the price. That way, if you extend the demand curve and you extend the period over which you discount, the discount begins to disappear. In the case of somebody with a very long reserve life like Exxon, what happens is that when you run out of the net present value case and you restart it again without the discount, you restart at 100. And that means that from my viewpoint, almost the entire oil and gas value chain is as much as 50% undervalued because they're using an incorrect price curve and an incorrect decline curve. I frankly love the fact that oil has a 50 handle on it because you're beginning to see a circumstance again where the market pricing is adding validity to the suggestion that we're going to run, you know, that we're going to abandon oil. The truth is that the oil markets and the gas markets too are suggesting that we're going to have a recession. Now, in that sense, they may be right. If we have a recession, that will impact copper markets, it'll impact financial markets, it'll impact everything. That recession will postpone, not eliminate, a future supply crunch in oil and gas. If you are somebody who would buy a great oil company at $50 and experience an awful lot of psychological trauma if it went to 40, and as a consequence of that, not still be around the stock when it went to about 250, you shouldn't buy the energy complex. If, by contrast, you think somebody like Warren Buffett is a decent investor, you might want to consider a sector that is selling at a substantial discount to net asset value for a reason that's both easy to understand and wrong. George Soros said that he made his fortune by finding broadly held public perceptions that were wrong and betting against them. And the widely held public perception is that fossil fuel energy is going to go the way of the dodo. Let me give you some interesting math. People say, well, Rick, what do you think about like alternative energies and stuff like that? I say, I think they're wonderful. You know, great, great stuff. We need lots of energy. But from an investment perspective, over 40 years, we've now spent almost $5 trillion on alternative energy and generation, and we've reduced the market share of fossil fuels from a high 40 years ago of 83% all the way down to 81% today. A $5 trillion investment has reduced the market share of fossil fuels by 2% over 40 years. That's pretty interesting math. And, you know, people need to pay more attention to math than to rhetoric in their investing.
Yeah. Let's talk specifics here. You said offline, and I want to make sure I get my word. Well, I'll let you say it again. Exxon as a stock, as a holding, if somebody wants to play the energy markets with Exxon, comment about that.
I think you have a tough time going wrong with Exxon. I mean, in the near term, sure. But listen, this is a truly integrated oil company. In times of high oil and gas prices, they make money at exploration and production. They make the money upstream. In times of lower oil prices, their refining and marketing margins widen out. They make the money downstream. Over 30 years, they've been superb allocators of capital. If you look at the oil industry as a whole, right now, the International Energy Agency estimates that the global oil and gas industry is underinvesting in sustaining capital investments to the extent of about $1 billion US a day. That means that 2 or 3 years out, to the producers, particularly the state-controlled producers, Pemex, PDVSA, will have a difficult time maintaining production. But Exxon is not. They're making the sustaining capital investments, in addition to spending $60 billion to buy Pioneer to increase their land holdings in the Permian Basin, which integrate well with their own. And in addition to that, they've made a discovery offshore Guyana that moves the dial on the largest oil producer in the world. While they do all that, they're increasing distributions to shareholders by way of dividends and share buybacks by 14% this year. In other words, they're generating so much cash that they have increased returns to shareholders while maintaining sustaining capital investments, while making a world-class discovery, while spending $60 billion to increase their footprint in their primary domestic production basin. There are other oil companies over 5 years that will doubtless experience greater share price increases than Exxon. But there is no oil company that I know of that has greater upside with less downside. Exxon is something that fits in every single portfolio. Will it be higher a year from now than it is today? I don't know. 5 years from now, if you include dividends and the share price, will people be happy that they bought Exxon? Absolutely.
About Exxon, I am a shareholder, just for full disclosure, as well as you told me, I can't remember if this was online or offline, but the great thing about investing in a lot of these energy producers is you participate not only but the upside, but you said a key word, you also collect the dividend. So you get both.
Our mutual friend Doug Casey once told me, he said, Rick, earned dividends are, quote, outward manifestations of inward grace. It is nice that they give you the money and nice that they can give you the money. Those are both good things.
That's well said. Let's go. And full disclosure, I do not own this other company. I have owned them in the past in my portfolio, but Devon Energy, tell me about them.
Devon and Equitable are both very important U.S. natural gas plays. I love both now. I loved both a year from now. As I say, some of the easy money in the natural gas trade has been made. What's important to know about both companies and the U.S. natural gas market in general is that it's a market that's going from oversupply, that is too much natural gas, to well-supplied. The current price for natural gas is in the range of $3.50 per million BTU. That same gas, in Shanghai or Tokyo or Rotterdam, is more like $11 per million BTU, and it costs about $2 a million BTU to get it there. That arbitrage is too great to last. It's just too great to last. While that's going on, billions of dollars are being spent in gas gathering, in gas storage, in gas transmission, in gas liquefaction, in the onshoring of, in particular, European energy-consuming industries from the heart of Europe, Germany in particular, to the U.S. Gulf and East Coast, where they can utilize U.S. natural gas. We said before on your show, Andy, the cure for low prices is always low prices. The low natural gas prices have increased the investment in infrastructure and facility to consume it. The consequence of that is that in 18 months, the natural gas price has gone from $1.25 per million BTU to 3.5 per million BTU. This is mysterious stuff. You just have to have the chutzpah to take advantage of it.
Got it. So last company I want to ask you about, in full disclosure, I do not own them, but they are on my watch list. And not only watch list, I'm more likely going to pounce after this interview is dropped. I do really like them. It's Surge Energy. It is a small energy producer out of Canada. Tell me about them.
I don't own Surge either because I had a buy list of 11 Canadian stocks, and they were all so attractive that anything that fell below that cutoff, generally the lower companies, didn't qualify. I know Surge well. I like Surge a lot. In doing what I do, which is talking to hundreds of thousands of investors a year, it is safer for me to recommend larger capitalization stocks where my own reputation doesn't move the stock. I like Surge. I do not own it. I like the whole Canadian oil and gas complex with one caveat. The Canadian oil and gas industry has survived 10 years of Liberal Party of Canada leadership under Justin Trudeau, who hated the oil and gas business. Ironically, he didn't see a business case for Canada's finest industry. He is being succeeded as Prime Minister of Canada by a guy named Mark Carney, who has the same rhetoric as Mr. Trudeau, but unfortunately is a more effective and efficient tyrant. So buying the Canadian oil and gas sector means that you buy a sector that you hope will thrive despite the political leadership of the country. That's the caveat that I have around Surge and the rest of my own Canadian energy portfolio. I own it, because it's so stupidly cheap with such amazing upside. But I'm very cognizant of the fact that the political leadership of the country is anti-energy.
So on that, this is kind of a, I don't know how to ask this. I'll just ask it. What's going to happen in Canada? I mean,
I'm pessimistic. I love Canada. I've lived there on and off. I've had an office in Canada for, I don't know, 45 years. I really, really enjoy the place. I've got lots and lots and lots of Canadian friends. In Canadian parlance, the Canadians have a predilection for own goals. In hockey, that's where you score a goal, unfortunately, in your own net. If you look at the voting history of Canada, it would seem that what I call the consolidated left, represented by the political parties known as the Liberals, the NDP, which is an overtly socialist party, the Greens, who are a watermelon party, green on the outside, red on the inside, and the Bloc Québécois, which is a regional leftist party, regularly command between 60 and 62% of the popular vote. Occasionally, Canada gets disgusted enough with the coalition that they throw them out. The conservative leader, Mr. Poilievre, who I don't know particularly well, ran a fairly successful campaign for 2 years that was anti-Trudeau, which went to the moon of Canada. Mr. Trudeau then resigned. And Mr. Poilievre's campaign, which was anti-Trudeau as opposed to for anything, has foundered. And it would appear that the consolidated left has found solace in the prospective leadership of Mark Carney. I hope that isn't the case. I hope that isn't the case. If you look at the economic performance of Canada over the last 10 years, if you look at the decline in living standards, if you look at the decline of the Canadian dollar, if you look at the increased level of government expenditure and government tax, concurrent with the increase of the deficit, what you will see is that Canada has been governed even more poorly than the United States has, which takes some real doing. And I'm afraid, unfortunately, that tendency will continue. I should note that I try not to criticize countries that I don't pay tax in, but I pay a lot of tax in Canada. So I feel like I've earned the right to speak my mind with regards to Canadian politics.
Thank you. And just for the record, I do not pay taxes in Canada, but I've spent a lot of time in Canada. I love the country, some of the nicest people and the most beautiful, beautiful scenery
that you will find
in the world. And they are home to a lot of natural resource companies that I do love. So,
agreed.
Steve,
we will.
I just want to say,
we'll create a wonderful.
I'm pro Canada myself.
And another commercial, we'll create a wonderful venue in Boca Raton, Florida for Canadian attendees and Canadian listed companies.
Yes, we will. And Steve will also be there. Steve, I promised I wouldn't put you on the spot, but I'm putting you on the spot. You have Rick Rule here. Do you have any final questions you'd like to ask Rick?
Besides gold, what commodities do you like?
Well, I'm attracted to hate, as you know, and nothing is really sufficiently hated enough to direct my attention. But as a thematic, what I'm attracted to is tier one deposits that are, and when I define tier one deposits, at least $10 billion in in-situ recoverable reserves and resources at today's commodity prices, preferably $20 billion, where the deposit, if brought into production, would be in the lowest cost quartile in its respective commodity, and where the return on capital employed would be in the best quartile, but at least 25%. I want deposits that are at least 5 years from production so that the discounts to net present value are the most extraordinary. I sort of like countries that are out of favor to add to the discount. And I love commodities that are out of favor. So one example would be a Brazilian, well, an Australian domiciled company exploring for rare earths in Brazil, who will be at the conference, Meteoric Resources. Well, almost nobody knows anything about rare earths. By the way, they're not very rare. We haven't looked for them because the Chinese produce them so cheaply. That's changing for reasons that we can go into in another discussion. This deposit is likely the largest rare earth deposit in the world, but it won't be in production for quite a while, at least 5 years. It will be, I'm certain, in the lowest cost quartile worldwide, the highest return on capital employed. But because of the lack of knowledge, the uncertainty, and in some senses, the investor hostility to the commodity, and because, too, some investors don't want to be in Brazil, and because of the uncertain timeline around production, this company is selling at about 10% of what we see as the net present value, prospective net present value of the deposit. A lot can change in 5 years. I think the deposit gets much larger, not merely larger. I think infill drilling means it becomes better understood, and the grade goes up. And over time, of course, that time discount changes. I love situations like, I love hate, I love boredom. Another example, who will also be at the conference, is a company called Sovereign Resources. Explorer developer in a country called Malawi, which most people can't spell. One, too, that elicits investor disrespect, because there isn't a lot of experience with Malawi. The commodities that they will produce, graphite and rutile, aren't particularly well known. And hence, nobody has much bull market experience in either commodity because there hasn't been one. This deposit will be either the first or second largest rutile deposit in the world and the first or second largest graphite deposit in the world. Reserves and resources comfortably in excess of $10 billion. Again, projected to inhabit the best part of the cost curve or the best part of the return on capital employed curve. You'll notice I'm looking for commodities that people either are bored of or hate. The other two probably involve nickel, sulfide nickel, and platinum and palladium. And for those, I would point again to exploration stage assets where the prospective asset is very, very large in countries that are out of favor and where the time value of money discount is excessive. So in direct answer to the question, I would say I'm attracted to, although I don't think it's bottomed out, platinum and palladium. I'm attracted to nickel, in particular sulfide nickel. I'm attracted to rare earths because I think they're undeservedly cheap. I think that the Chinese cost advantage is going away because the Chinese people and the Chinese state will cease to endure the environmental disaster wrought in Xinjiang by traditional Chinese production practices. That's changing right now. A lot of Western investors don't understand the extent to which the political traction around environmental remediation is happening in China. But those of us who follow the Chinese mining industry do know. And it's an important trend that people need to pay attention to. And I'm always attracted to industrial materials where there's the potential for a world-dominating deposit, much like the deposit in Malawi is. So I realized that was an elliptical answer to the question, but it was also an applied answer.
Rick, I love it. It just makes me want to put another plug in for the conference, and we look forward to seeing you in Boca Raton.
I really look forward to hosting you there. It's important that your audience that it intends to come to the conference try to book their hotel rate sooner rather than later. The hotel that we're at today, if you book the room, would be $1,200 a night. We're going to turn the room to you as long as the rooms last for $340 a night. it's important, too, that one of the best events of the conference is the boat cruise, where we take as many attendees as we can fit on the boat on a cruise of the Intercoastal Canal for 3 hours, where they get to talk to Daniela DiMartino Booth and David Stockman and all of those people in, let's say, unguarded moments after I've poured spirituous beverage in them. That boat cruise will sell out. And if you don't make arrangements to be on that cruise, you miss one of the best and least guarded moments of the conference.
If someone wants to be on the boat cruise, I know Andy's going to put the link in, but what's the website for the boat cruise?
I'll put it on. Go ahead, Rick.
Yeah, the website, I think, will probably be posted in the video. And you will see at the bottom of the drop-down menu the ability to reserve your spot on the boat cruise. We've been offering this damn boat cruise in two countries for 30 years, in Canada and the United States, and we've always sold it out. I'm pretty sure in Boca Raton this year we could sell out an aircraft carrier. Unfortunately, we don't have access to an aircraft carrier, so we're going to sell it out again.
My shameless plug, I was on the boat cruise last year. It was absolutely fantastic. Had a lot of off-the-record conversations that were fantastic. Also, real quick before we leave, Meteoric Resources, they were at your conference last year, correct? You saw me look to my left. I was going to look for their card because I have their card here. They're on my list. But I was going to look for my card. They got that card at your conference.
One of the things that happens at the conference is the networking. Daniela DiMartino Booth, who was a speaker at the conference, did the intelligent thing that an old Goldman Sachs partner would do. She went around and she talked to all the exhibitors. She heard the rare earth story and she heard the importance of U.S. politics to the rare earth supply chain, and she ultimately became a director of Meteoric, something that I haven't figured out a way to bill her or Meteoric for, but I'll work on that.
We'll work on it together. Rick, you got to run. I got to run. I'm late for something, but I just want to tell you again, thank you so much for your time. It's always a pleasure. I'll reach out to Kelly to get you on soon, and if I can't, we'll see you in Florida.
I look forward to hosting you both and as many of your listeners as for whom it's convenient to come either live or via live stream to Boca Raton.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you.